Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben. This is A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. How are you doing? I hope you're all right. Nice to have you along. I am going to the Arles Photo Festival on Wednesday, so that means by the time you're hearing this, either I'm in the air, or maybe I'm even there already, quite possibly there already. I'm leaving obscenely early in the morning on Wednesday, with good old, of course, the world's most despised airline, Ryanair. So, assuming they actually get me there, I will be there as you listen to this, hopefully, and I will It'll be bringing you a podcast special from the Arles Festival, which you can enjoy at your leisure as and when I get back and get it put together. So, barring disasters, that'll be happening. Anyway, I digress. Let me start by saying that this episode of A Small Voice podcast is sponsored by the renowned cutting-edge photography journal Hot Shoe International. Based in London and distributed worldwide, Hot Shoe magazine is a truly independent publication which has been consistently serving a wide readership of creatively-minded individuals since 1977. Beautifully produced and collectible, each issue focuses on a movement, person or moment in the photographic canon, ranging from New York street photography to a comprehensive retrospective of the late artist Chris Killip. Hot Shoe issue 207, A West African Portrait, will be released this month and will include the work and voices of artists such as Sanle Sori, Seydou Keita and Rashida Bisirio. This beautifully produced publication exploring photography from West Africa was made in partnership with Autograph London and David Hill Gallery and addresses questions such as what sets West African photography apart and how has it changed over time. The crude metaphors section features a brilliant piece by Sala Elise Patterson entitled Hoarding the Porto Novo Night, and there are reviews of four newly released photo books. Hot Shoe is offering you, my listener, a 20% discount on all pre-orders when you enter the code SMALLVOICE20 at checkout. So that's small voice and then the number 20. So go to hotshoemagazine.com and start your 2022 subscription now. So yeah, looking forward to Arles, looking forward to seeing some good photography and some exhibitions and generally hanging out in what is a very lovely place. It's going to be hot as usual, but can't complain about that, can we? Yeah, and I'll be looking forward to bumping into some old friends and some friends of the podcast and maybe getting some check-ins if there's any previous guests there. So I've got the brilliant Greg Williams this week as my guest, and I will be introducing him properly as usual in a second. If you want to become a member of this podcast and help in its ongoing production, but also get access to exclusive subscriber-only content on your own special podcast feed, then go and sign up at pod.fan for a mere £5 a month to become a member and get that exclusive content. £5 a month, that's two cups of coffee, people, per month. All I need to say about that. So, this episode of Small Voice is also sponsored by the Charcoal Book Club, the monthly subscription service for photo book enthusiasts that brings essential, limited edition and hard-to-find photo books to your doorstep. The rest, I'm sure you probably know. They offer free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and you get all sorts of other exclusive perks as a member. So, if you go to the charcoalbookclub.com, not the charcoalbookclub.com, go to charcoalbookclub.com and have a look at the previous books of the month, and you can sign up as a member to get museum quality first edition books to add to your shelves, hand-picked by Charcoal's expert curators. And as a Small Voice listener, you can get a 10% discount on your first membership payment. So that's a 10% discount if you use the code A Small Voice at checkout. So go to charcoalbookclub.com. The upcoming book of the month I was interested to note is As It Was Given to Me by Stacey Kranitz. So that's an interesting one. Stacey Kranitz, I'd very much like to get on the podcast at some point. So that's a sort of note to self, really. Finally, before I introduce Greg, there is one more sponsor I need to give you. This episode of Small Voice is supported by Flow Photographic, a leading internationally renowned photographic print studio in central London, where the emphasis is on personal service and the creation of stunning prints, and where clients are invited to take their time, drink coffee and discuss their work with Flow founder and hugely experienced master printer, Alex Schneiderman. The studio, which also carries out exhibition framing and installation, is located in central London, 20 minutes from Soho and a minute's walk from Kensal Green Tube Station. Recent clients, including leading photographers such as Joel Mayovitz, Paddy Summerfield, Sheffield, Jem Southern, Mimi Plum, Chris Anderson, Matthew Finn, Alice Tomlinson, and Sunil Gupta, as well as Magnum Photo, Stanley Barker Publishing, the Howard Greenberg Gallery, Huxley Parlour, and other museums and art institutions all over the world. The lab is also home to Flow Photographic Gallery, a non-profit space that supports and showcases British documentary photography. So go to the website, flowphotographic.com, and call Flow today to make an appointment to discuss your work. So, Greg Williams, some of you may have come here for the first time to listen to this chat with Greg, because he's got a million Instagram followers. And that was one of several reasons why I was keen to get a chat in with Greg and invite him on. And I was very pleased when he decided to join me to do it. And he's a very down-to-earth person, is Greg. And as he said himself, I'm not mad enough to think that those 1 million followers have come for my photography. So he is fully acknowledging of the fact that most of those followers, of course, have come to look at the people who he photographs, which happens to be the sort of A-list of the A-list Hollywood celebs, mostly. And so let me introduce Greg. This is the bio from his own website. Greg Williams is one of the most trusted and acclaimed photographers in entertainment. His name and candid portraiture synonymous with authentic glamour. Greg established his reportage style as a photojournalist in the 90s, covering war zones in Burma, Chechnya, and Sierra Leone. An assignment for the Sunday Times magazine gave Greg his first access to the film industry, and he has now shot specials on over 200 movies, including 4 poster campaigns for the Bond franchise. Greg has also enjoyed exclusive access to BAFTA, the Golden Globes, and the Oscars, and is a regular contributor to Vanity Fair and British Vogue. In addition to his prodigious photographic output, Greg is also a filmmaker, principally with his first-person moving reportage documentaries, and a product designer. Greg's limited edition Leica Q2, in partnership with Daniel Craig, is Leica's fastest-selling large-scale edition. His education platform, Skills Faster, is home to his highly successful Candid Photography course with the intention of democratizing good photography. After 30 years in the business, Greg's talent and brand relationship are second to none. He publishes exclusives to over 1 million followers on Instagram, as I already mentioned, and on gregwilliams.com, where he also sells his products and prints. And Greg Williams Photography operates from Greg's studio gallery space in Mayfair, London. Check that space out, by the way, on his website. I wouldn't like to think how much that costs, but Greg has got one, and it looks pretty spectacular, apart from being in the most expensive part of one of the most expensive cities in the whole of the world. So, yeah, Greg's a fascinating person. That photography course that he does, as he says in the course of our chat, has sold 40,000 downloads so far. So you can currently buy that course, the basic one, for £34, which, you know, you've got to admit is a bit of a bargain. And you do the maths, folks. You do the maths. It has in previous times been actually much more expensive than that. So you're getting a great discount if you sign up at that price. But that's Greg. I had a really interesting chat with him, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. This is Greg Williams. So you're here in the UK?
Yeah, I'm at home. I live in Berkshire. I live outside of London.
Yeah. Because I've got to assume that you know, your work being what it is, you must spend quite a lot of time out in LA. How does your year kind of generally pan out on a non-Bond year?
Well, award season is when, so basically I tend to spend quite a lot of time, like I was there 6 weeks at the beginning of this year, up until the end of March, up until the Oscars. And as that, but then, you know, I say that I'm back for the BAFTAs. I'm not in LA probably as much as you'd think. I'm quite active when I am in LA. Yeah. So I get a lot done, but you know, I'm probably there maybe 2.5 months a year.
Oh, okay. So that's manageable. Cause I know you know, you've got a family here and all that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You got all that going on. One thing I wanted to do really was kind of have a little overview of your career to date, really, because it's an interesting story that you've got, and I think a lot of my listeners won't be aware of, you know, your sort of photojournalistic roots,
yeah,
and how it all kind of came out of that. But also, you know, you've hit 1 million Instagram followers, which is pretty amazing.
Thank you.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about, I suppose it seemed like a nice moment of, I think you turned 50 as well. So
I'm turning 50 this August.
I suppose I'm looking for little kind of reasons to have a moment of reflection, but it seemed like that's a good excuse. The Instagram thing, I mean, everyone kind of covets followers, but what does it mean in practice for you to sort of have that kind of following? I heard you mention that it was a kind of a game changer for you, Instagram.
Yeah, I mean, it was because of how I chose to use it, and not everyone chooses to use it in the way I do, and not everyone has the option to. You know, I'm not mad enough to think those million people are only there for the photos. You know, they're obviously there for my subjects.
Yeah.
To a great extent. So, you know, if you're a landscape photographer, it's going to be very difficult to get to the same place as if you're photographing movie stars. And that's, you know, a simple thing that isn't, I promise you, is not missed on me. But what it means for me, I mean, it's been absolutely... what's the word for it? My English is so awful. But it's been transformative for my career in so much as before I had a decent Instagram following, before I started working in a way where I prioritized my social media, I was very much at the whim of other people to give me work. And there were times when that was very rewarding and successful, and there were other times where it was ghastly and quiet and terrifying. And I know any freelance photographer has felt those those two emotions, those two imposters. And all I can say is that I suppose what I decided about 6 years ago was that, you know, I would continue to do stuff I had to do to earn money, but my big aim was to get to a point where I get paid to do exactly what I do. And that wasn't immediate, and it definitely, you know, it did take some time. I say 6 years, it's 8 years. I think it was 2014 I got an Instagram account, and it probably wasn't till 2016, 2017 that I started to really see that paying off, that people were saying, no, we want you to do what we see on your Instagram feed. Mm-hmm. Because I'd done a lot of commercial work, a lot of advertising work, a lot of lit stuff, a lot of set builds, a lot of stuff that required a huge amount of production. And for me, there was something about bringing that all back into one man with the cameras that fit into his shoulder bag, walking into a room without anybody else needed other than a subject. And so I pushed that very hard. And basically, I would do advertising jobs. I'd earn some money. And then I would go and shoot exactly what I wanted to shoot. And I'd worked in the film industry since the mid-90s, or since 1997. So I knew people. And I had decent relationships. And I suppose I empowered myself by no longer waiting for the phone to ring. Mm-hmm. I just went off and said, look, I'm here. You know, I'm at Cannes. Can I pop into your room for 5 minutes before you walk a red carpet? Or I'd ask actors that, or I'd ask publicists that, or I'd ask film companies that. And as they started seeing the results, more and more people started inviting me in. And what's interesting is that, you know, you were asking about my early life story as a photojournalist. And actually what I do today, you know, resembles the photography I was doing when I was 16 to 20, more than the work I was doing in my 30s. Yeah. I found a bunch of contact sheets that I'd taken at school when I was 16. And all my mates in the pictures are going, whoa, and reacting to me, and I'm photographing these reactions. I didn't take a picture like that for the middle 15 years of my career. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking through these contact sheets going, oh my God, that's literally what I'm doing today, but now I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, you know? Well, that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, you just sort of crystallized my thought, which was that, you know, your kind of photojournalistic roots, you know, are coming into play all the time now, because that is, you know, like one man and a little Leica kind of thing is exactly your modus operandi, and it's very unusual for someone who photographs the kind of people you photograph, but that is your kind of USP in a way.
Mm-hmm. It is, and I suppose if I hadn't gone through everything else, because it is funny, I do, like, that's what you see on my Instagram. There's a lot of other work I do. You know, I do, you know, for instance, I just did the posters for Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, of course.
3, right? And these are, you know, huge studio shoots, multi-setups, you know, an enormous amount of very, very high-powered lighting and a lot of real, you know, stuff that I've, I suppose, learned over the years. And what I'm trying to do in those situations are take photographs that still have an authenticity to them. And, you know, I'm trying to recreate the sunlight that I would, in an ideal world, have in order to take the picture that I'm trying to take. And so there's something about having learned all that stuff that then means I'm able to still do those commercial jobs, but I'm able to bring more authenticity to them than I'd ever been able to in the past.
Mm.
I started learning lighting literally from assistants teaching me. And right. So, you know, it was like an Alan Cron with a softbox. And of course, my pictures looked like everybody else's pictures that was using an Alan Cron with a softbox. Mm. And what I love now about the way that I work is I'll walk into a hotel room with someone and I've got a minute and a half to get a picture, and it may be someone I've never met before, and they may be exceedingly nervous about what they're about to go and do. And I now walk into a room and I see the light coming in the room, and I imagine that light was all given to me. I imagine I've walked into a set. And I'm like, okay, what is the light that's lighting? What light would I put up to create this light through the window? And I imagine everything is a given light. And then I try and maximize the potential of shooting my subject and where to place my subject within that light as if it has all been given to me. Mm. And it isn't just because I've walked in at 4:20 in the afternoon in a south-facing window.
Yeah. And I guess the sort of photographers who are used to being able to control all of that would probably, you know, panic a little bit at the idea that they've got to use what's available. But that's more in your kind of DNA from the start.
Oh, no, I love it. I mean, for me, yes, it's in there from the start. But I didn't know it at the start. I didn't know, you know, I wasn't consciously aware that picture worked because it was backlight, or that, you know, sidelight had a great way of showing, you know, emphasizing wrinkles on someone's face to show old. Though I wasn't aware of it, I would just see it and take the picture. Mm. And now I feel incredibly aware of it, and as a result I feel very empowered. And there's something I love, you know, I love the idea that you go into an environment that you shouldn't be able to take a picture, or in theory, you know, it's like downlighters, you know, downlighters in, you know, little halogen downlighters you get in hotel rooms.
Yeah.
You know, what a nightmare they
horrible.
Normally are.
Yeah.
And they create these horrible panda eyes. So, you know, I've worked out, no, if you rotate the head and I get up high, suddenly that's an amazing key light.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, it's not just the light. It's where is your subject in relation to the light, and where are you in relation to your subject? And so, I mean, even to the point, I remember I did there's a portrait that I love of Johnny Depp, and he's in a van driving back at night from a film set, and he's got towels all over him and a toweling dressing gown because he's had to submerge himself in water for the scene before the end of the day. Anyway, we're driving back. And you know those horrible little LED lights you get in cars next to the doors?
Yeah.
And I see this light, and it's amazing. Like, he looks like some mad sage wizard sort of thing. It's incredible looking in this light, but it's so low light. And I do a picture in a moving car, and I'm on a 75mm lens, which means, you know, I'm probably handheld at 1/4 of a second. and we get these amazing photos, and you get them because you sort of, you've learned a few things. So you know what the light's doing. You know that if you, you know, hold your breath and keep your shutter down and don't move the camera, at some point you're going to get a still frame. And I fire 20, 30 frames, and lo and behold, three or four of them are sharp. And you're getting a photo that you would never have dreamt of doing if all you did was cart a bunch of strobes around with you every day, no, putting them up in your one lighting setup and shooting it. So you sort of, you learn. For me, it's a real buzz. I love it. There's a real excitement of defying all the odds and coming away with a picture. Mm. It's probably one of my favourite things about what I do.
Yeah, yeah. And also, but what I think, that, like, your kind of characteristic, your kind of trademark, really, that when you're photographing these kind of A-list celebs, full-on Hollywood royalty, this incredible intimacy that you have established and that you always get. I mean, like, these are people who are used to having big production, you know, numbers the whole time. Everything, you know, everywhere they go, they're surrounded by people. And, you know, you walk into a shoot and they might expect to find a big setup, you know, kind of Annie Leibovitz style, you know, 20 people. But maybe is it the fact that you are very stripped down that they're responding to in a way, that they're kind of creative people and they understand that you're doing something a little bit different in a way by just having it, you know, so stripped back?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm going in there to be entirely collaborative, right? I said one of my favourite things is getting the, is working in an environment you shouldn't be able to get a picture and getting one. The thing that I love the very most about my job is working with creative talent. And when you work with amazing talent, great ideas come out, right? And a much better idea than I would have on my own. And I go back to that idea of being a portrait photographer that, you know, I shoot, I have a light here, a light here, a light here, and I bring a subject in and I place them and that's the picture. There's not a lot of collaboration in that. And my shoots are entirely collaborative because we go in with a total open book. There's a really nice example of this where I... During lockdown, I went and did a shoot with Kate Winslet. And because it was lockdown, there was no glam team at all. There was no production. There was nothing like that. So I turn up on my own just with my little shoulder bag of cameras. And she does her own makeup. And then we choose some clothes. And this thunderstorm starts. And I'm like, we've just been given a really expensive effect here, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'd normally have water towers and you'd have effects crews. We've been given a thunderstorm. Let's go out in the thunderstorm. And I'd shot Kate before near the ocean and she'd sort of been willing to sort of get her feet a bit wet and do stuff. And I knew that she wasn't, you know, she was open stuff. And anyway, what we ended out with was this mad image where we walked into the ocean together until she was up to her shoulders in the ocean. Now, bear in mind, we'd chosen the clothes. She'd done her own makeup. And there's me holding an umbrella with a Leica. And her husband's there, and he's been helping us out. And he actually took one of my cameras and took a beautiful photo of the simplicity of this shoot. And the end result was this picture of Kate in a thunderstorm in the sea with water dropping all over. And it's a really strong portrait. It's one of my strongest portraits. And had that have been a cover for Vanity Fair, and it was the sort of image could have been, and you turned around, there would have been 40, 50 people there.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They'd have been safety divers. They'd have been, God, I can't even tell you how. There would have been so much equipment and stuff and styling and everything there, and hot rooms ready to warm her up the second she got out and all this stuff. And what we got by her ideas, my ideas, collaboration, was something that was a picture I haven't seen before. And it was there because we were both open to that collaboration.
Yeah. And she definitely comes across as a kind of person who's sort of super unpretentious and very kind of, you know, up for things. But as an outsider, you know, one imagines there's a lot of kind of diva-ishness amongst those kind of people. But it's kind of encouraged to some extent because that the world they live in, they're pampered constantly. But I guess in your experience or from looking from your pictures, most of them don't seem like that at all. They seem like totally like, you know, up for things and relaxed about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly what you look for, and it's now what people know. I mean, don't get me wrong. When you've always got to start at the beginning when it's a fresh relationship, yeah. Mm. But the more you've worked with someone, the more you can start off from a place of, you know, they know what I'm looking for. I'm looking for authentic moments. I'm looking for pictures that make the audience feel like they're there in the room. And there's a lot of sort of first person in my pictures. There's a lot of time you'll see people literally reacting to the person behind the camera.
Yeah.
I often shoot people the second I greet them or the second I do something. And so I think it's very much what you get. I mean, I don't think of my subjects as celebrities. I think of them as artists. And when I say that, the difference is that a celebrity is someone that you put on a pedestal and you almost worship them, right? And an artist, for me, it's like two artists get together and they make some pictures. And I know people might be used to all the, you know, what you could call the bullshit of all the stuff that's around. Mm. But certainly the people that I shoot a lot, they love that it's not present in my shoots.
Yeah.
You know, because actually that stuff is tiring. You don't always want 20 people you've never met before staring at you when you're doing your thing. Mm. And, you know, and most actors aren't models at all. You know, I mean, There are a few who came up the ranks from modelling, just fantastic looking, and then had the talent and the interest and moved into acting. But for most part, you know, when you act, you try and create someone else's reality. And so the idea that you take that person, you then put them in a room with 30 fashion assistants and fire flashes at them, that's supposed to be able to give them the same stuff is actually, I think, quite terrifying to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You chose the exact example that I was going to ask you about, so thanks for you know, mentioning the Kate Winslet one, because that was, of course, the one I was going to ask you about.
Was it?
Yeah, for sure. It was because, you know, it was a perfect example of that approach that you have. And there's a great one of Jodie Foster as well, which is sort of similarly kind of very candid, and she looks so natural. And, you know, she's been in the business a long time. I imagine she, you know, she's been around the block a few times, and to see her so unguarded and sort of relaxed just seemed it's a very sort of, you know, refreshing kind of thing, and it seems to be, you know, what you do well.
Funnily enough, that photo you're talking about, the one that feels a bit 60s, right? She's in a hotel suite, is that right?
I think it was kind of almost like you were done, really, and she was, I think she was looking in her bag or something. I haven't got it.
She literally just looked up to say goodbye, and I was like, that's actually the picture.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, so you sort of try and not change anything, and I'm like turning my camera back on, and I'm going, no, it's that, and you don't want anything to change, and she just did exactly the same thing again. And,
Which, of course, she would be good at doing. But I think what's really interesting to a lot of people will be, or I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, the stuff that you're putting on Instagram, I kind of guess I would have assumed it was commissions. But what you're doing is shooting specifically for your Instagram account for a lot of the time. Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of it is. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are certainly at the festivals you'll often find that I was, you know, that there's a lot of luxury brands that employ me to go and take pictures, but I will take the pictures whether I'm commissioned or not.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think, you know, the more and more you get into it, the more and more you find a commercial outlet for the stuff you're doing. Mm-hmm. But no, it's absolutely that. Have you had Hollywood Authentic yet? Have you had the magazine?
No, I was going to ask you about it.
Have you not?
I'd love to see a copy.
I want to show it to you right now.
Yeah.
that's Hollywood Authentic.
Yeah. So this is a map, just to explain, because obviously the listeners can't see it, but
can they? It's a very good point.
you've created your own magazine, and it looks like a beautiful thing, and yeah, I mean that's again, you know, you keep yourself pretty busy there, Greg, with all these different projects, but that's something you've done what as a kind of passion project. I mean, I presume you've got a way of making some income out of it though eventually.
Not yet, but eventually I hope to. Yeah, I mean we've got a few advertisers who've been very kindly supporting us, but not yet to the extent that it pays for the whole thing.
Yeah.
But the idea really was, it was kind of like what I've done with the Instagram. It was like taking that to the next level, I suppose, and actually producing something that you could hold, or that has, you know, if you look at, you know, the center spread, you know, you've got lovely big photos.
Oh, good,
and you actually see pictures. But I suppose the other principle of it was slightly it's a love letter to Hollywood, but it's also kind of a love letter to the magazine journalism that I aspired to when I was growing up. And don't get me wrong, it was before my time. It was my childhood time when I wasn't looking at magazines. But, you know, the era that I'm referring to kind of ended in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, Life magazine, Look magazine, Stern, Parry Match, and how the Sunday Times magazine, right? And how these magazines would do big spreads and 4,000 word stories, and you'd go and really spend time with someone. And it didn't all have to have a commercial, or especially a fashion bent to it, right?
Yeah,
it wasn't about what they were wearing, it was about them. And so, you know, it was a really weird time to launch. We were launching the magazine as the Russian invasion was getting underway in Ukraine. It did seem like a really odd time to do something like that. So we were very lucky that we got Sean Penn agreed to do the first cover.
Mm.
But I spent 4 hours with him, and I went to his home. He went to his sort of like pied-à-terre in LA, and then he drove me over to Malibu, and we just talked, and I record the conversations, and then I give them to an absolute world-class writer to write them up into an article. And I'm incredibly proud of the words, and don't get me wrong, I'm dyslexic, and I could not have written them up in any way like the people do that do this stuff for me. But what you sense is this extremely intimate, authentic conversations that absolutely are in line with the photography.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so in a way, it's my little way of saying this is how, you know, if I had a total blank canvas, this is how I would do my work.
Mm. Well, it's like that thing, really, that you scratched your own itch there, really, by you know, that thing of wanting. I mean, we all, I think a lot of us miss, as you've kind of alluded to, that the times of print magazines. And I think, you know, probably when you started out, there was a bit of a kind of revival of that, you know, in the 90s in
Absolutely.
The UK. You know, there was the Independent and stuff, and
yeah.
That's probably the sort of work that you were inspired by at that point. But
but
certainly now, you know, yeah, to see that lovely big large format magazine you got there with that big old center spread, I mean, that just goes to show how fantastic a printed image can look. Mm. And you've created your own outlet in a way.
Well, it's an interesting thing. So what we do, so we don't sell them. The other thing you've worked out is you can't sell magazines, so I'm not trying. Yeah. So they're free. You just got to subscribe, and at some point I'll work out the commercialization of it. And I know it's there. I just don't know what it is. But I know it's not expecting people to go into newsagents and buy your magazine.
Right.
So we have, you know, we've got a good online presence, and we've got you know, that we've got a good social media wise. We've got a good way of telling people this is here. You know, you should look at it. Idea is that you give it away for nothing to people that want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's subscription only. But if you want one, just subscribe. HollywoodAuthentic.com.
Yeah, yeah, you can sign up. I'm sure a lot of people will. I mean, what a fantastic thing to have that for free. It looks great, and I'm sure you'll figure out a way to sort of, you know, monetize it one way or another. But
I'm sure we will. Yeah. I'm sure we will.
I mean, you're good at all that stuff. I mean, I don't know if it's deliberate or whether it just happens as a kind of a fringe benefit of you pursuing the things that interest you. It's a bit like you said before. You did the classic thing. You decided what you wanted to do, and then you tried to figure out a way of making that possible, rather than kind of like a lot of us do, come to the conclusion, well, that just isn't a thing, you know, that isn't going to happen, that isn't a thing.
Yes,
yeah. It's very interesting to hear that you know you didn't do that. You really kind of found a way and did it with the Instagram thing.
I'm finding a way.
Finding a way.
Well, finding a way.
I'm sure you remember. You must remember a time when you had like 5,000 followers on Instagram, right?
And then, of course I do. Yeah, it wasn't long ago. Yeah,
amazing thing. Well, like, so going back to this kind of the magazine thing and the 90s and photojournalism, like, I think you knew when you were very young that you were interested in photography. I think you might hold the record for the youngest camera owner on this podcast, Greg.
Yeah, well, I was telling anyone that wanted to hear me that I was going to be a photographer when I was six.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, and I had a very creative and supportive family.
Amazing.
And I was desperately dyslexic. And found school difficult, found writing, reading difficult. And so and I had no hand-eye coordination for art either. You know, right. My mother and my brother were both artists, and I didn't inherit that in any way. So I couldn't draw. So the camera was like the obvious tool for me. And you know, they do say, you know, it's good not to have too many options in life.
Right.
And I really didn't. And by the time I left school at 16, I didn't have options in life. You know, I had one option, which was to make the photography work.
So no plan B kind of thing. That, like you say, that can be in a way it could be a weird kind of an advantage.
Yeah, if you're going to put in the work. If you're not, it's a huge disadvantage, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's obviously a lot. It's a lot of work.
But what was it about photojournalism or documentary that kind of attracted you? Because that was the road that you were going down for quite a while.
Yeah, it's a weird one. I mean, certainly from the photography standpoint, it was the pictures I was taking. You know, my dad bought me a book, Magnum, 40 Years of Magnum.
Mm.
When I was probably about 12 years old, I guess, I got that book. And I started seeing how a picture could tell an entire story in one image. And I loved the idea that the people doing it were going off on their own and doing it. The idea that it was just down to you and your eye. And I never dreamt of having assistants or putting up lights at that point. It never occurred to me. I'd never left Europe. I hadn't seen the world. I hadn't done stuff. And I read Don McCullen's book, Unreasonable Behaviour, and just thought, oh my God, what an incredible, interesting, mad, wild life. That's what I want. I think I just wanted to be interesting.
Yeah.
And do interesting stuff. And so I, you know, my poor parents must have absolutely shat themselves. But I went off. I went to my first war zone when I was 19. I got smuggled into Burma with the Karen guerrillas, with a mate of mine who was videoing. And we did that. And then, you know, came back to England, got an agent, was with a news agency called Select. I then covered like droughts in southern Africa, and I did stuff, but I was also I was also sent out on jobs in London. You know, I remember photographing Princess Diana walking into a movie premiere once on some horrible high ladder because I hadn't got there in time, and was shooting Transparency with a Metz manual flash and, you know, like ruining everything because all I'd done so far was shoot black and white negative film, and it was all very easy. And had this horrible sort of realization that whereas I may have had an eye, I was absolutely, I had no technical knowledge whatsoever, really.
Right.
No proper technical knowledge. And then I, and so I sort of got myself into this situation where suddenly that's what I was doing, and I was going to war zones to take pictures. And I went to Sierra Leone, no, I went to Chechnya. I was in Grozny for the Russian assault in Chechnya in 1995, which I was just, I suppose, very lucky. I got away without any terrible experiences, but saw a lot of very mad stuff. And then went to Sierra Leone straight after that at a really bad time in that country's history and absolutely shat myself, got really scared, really nearly came very close to dying on a number of occasions, and came back and was like, fuck this, I'm not doing that again.
So that was the moment, right? That was the
I was 23. I was 23 and I was like, absolutely no way am I doing that again. And it, you know, and it properly, you know, the experiences were bad and they sat with me, well, they still sit with me now, but they sat with me in a sort of in a not particularly good way for about 8 years. Well, it took about 2 years to start, ended after about 8 years. But it was a very full on. And yeah, I was like, that is not my life's path. And I want to live.
It's definitely not for everyone that pursuit. And you find out, I guess, one way or the other. Who were some of your contemporaries at that time then that you were kind of hanging out with?
Contemporaries, I don't know. I mean, the people, I suppose.
Or friends.
Well, okay, so probably my best, one of my best mates at that time was a guy called Charles Omini, who went on to be Newsweek's White House photographer. And me and him, we never went to wars together, but we were going to places at the same time. And he went to Rwanda when I was on my way somewhere else. And it was, you know, just both of us, obviously, sort of, both of us having pretty minging experiences. In Chechnya was when I suppose I met the big guys, you know, like there's Christopher Morris, who I'm friends with today. He actually sent me a contact sheet the other day of some pictures that of Russian prisoners in a cellar in Grozny that I'd lit with my I had a little mag light torch and I lit them, and he sort of photographed using that light. And I met James Natchway and I met all those guys there.
Yeah.
But I always say people do say, oh, you know, tell me about when you were a war photographer. I'm like, I was never a war photographer. Those guys are war photographers. You know, Chris Morris, James Natchway, they're war photographers, right? I was never that. I flirted with it for about 6 weeks of my life in total. Had the shit scared out of me and
decided
that was not for me. So yeah, I don't deserve that title.
Yeah, yeah. But then you were met with the challenge then of deciding, well, what am I gonna, what now kind of thing, or you know, what now. At some point James Bond came along for you, and I don't want to sort of, like, you know, sort of create this sort of simplistic narrative, but it seems to me it's a classic example of a real life-changing moment in a way. Does that seem like a fair summary?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of them. A lot happened between it. So I photographed my last war in 1995. And I worked on my first Bond film, I think, in 2000, right? So there was 5 years between that. And basically, I came back, I did photojournalism. I continued to be a photojournalist. I just wasn't putting myself in harm's way. I did some quite heavy stories, like I've documented a woman, well, really more her family dealing with their daughter dying of CJD, the human strain of mad cow disease. I did stories on child bereavement. I did my first Sunday Times magazine cover on a brain damage rehabilitation unit for kids. So I was doing these quite heavy, you know, quite heavy photojournalism, but in England.
Yeah.
And then I was balancing that with really silly, quirky stories. Like, I went to Holland and photographed show jumping bunny rabbits, or I went and photographed a human household who were zookeepers bringing a baby gorilla up with their baby. And these stories, I would shoot them, and you know, like, you know, I made no money doing the war zones. story of a baby gorilla growing up in a human household. It must have sold 60 or 70 times. I was with Rex Features, who took terrific care of me. Mm-hmm. And they used to send me off on these jobs. And, you know, a story like that, or Show Jumpy Bunny Rabbits, you know, you might make 10, 15 grand in syndication from that. You know, Parry Match would do a 4-page story of Show Jumping Bunny Rabbits and pay a good amount of money for it. So it was a really weird balance that I was doing sort of concerned photojournalism with these really quirky stories that I had a sort of knack of finding a good picture in, and had the right agency at the time to sell them. Rex were fantastic at flogging those things. You know, page 3 of the Daily Mail for $3,000 for some ID, just run off.
That was bad.
Fantastic. You know, when you're a 20, if I'd have been 26, 27 year old kid. Anyway, I then, after the CJD story for the Sunday Times, the picture editor at the time, Aidan Sullivan, who's still a mate of mine, Aidan said, look, what do you want to do next? You know, that was full on. Just decide, choose something and we'll back you. And I said, all right, I want to do the British film industry. And the Full Monty had come out the year before and everyone was sort of championing the rebirth of British cinema. And over the course of several years, the loads of tax incentives were brought in. And suddenly England was making like 100 feature films a year. And I was going on loads of them. And sad to say, you know, a huge percentage of them never even got released. You know, I think certainly there was, the tax incentives maybe brought some of the wrong money in at times, and a lot of things were greenlit that maybe wouldn't have been today. But anyway, I would get on film sets, and the first film set I went on was, and it's weird, I can't remember, it's either Elizabeth, the first Elizabeth with Cate Blanchett, or Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. But that was the season, that was the era. And I shot basically from 1997 till 2000. I did this project and it became way bigger than the Sunday Times. It became a book that Rankin published for me. And it was called Greg Williams on Set. And it was that book that the producers of the Bond film saw.
Right.
And that's how I got into Bond. So it wasn't, it didn't go from one to the other, yeah.
But again, you sort of made your own luck there in a sense, because you put the sort of spade work in for 3 years without, without a lot of reward for it.
No, I didn't sell any pictures. Yeah. I was so scared of upsetting publicists, because, you know, it's a real, it's sort of a minefield, Hollywood. Like, you know, if you've got to really go in slow. You know, I love that saying, you have to give people what they want in order to give them what you want. And you really have to go in slowly, slowly. And I was so scared of upsetting people or being blacklisted, I suppose, not being able to work because I'd, you know, released an image that wasn't approved. I was so scared of all that stuff that I just kept my head down until I'd done my book. And I got every single image approved in the book and put it out there. So, you know, anyone outside of the people that had literally let me on their film set didn't have a clue I existed as a Hollywood photographer until the book came out.
Right. So then, what was the first Bond film?
It was Die Another Day.
Right, okay.
So Pierce Brosnan and Halle Berry.
They saw the book, but they wanted something like that, did they? Some sort of behind the scenes, because normally when you're on set as a you know, doing a film, like, it's, you're kind of, there's certain sort of on set photography which is really all about getting publicity steals. But you were basically working, you know, as a sort of photojournalism, documenting the production process essentially.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, so every film has a unit photographer, and that person works with the unit and they take behind the scenes photos. But I suppose for the main part, their primary job is to get a high quality version of the great shots from the film.
Yeah.
For publicity. And in the old days it was transparencies and they get duplicated and sent out around the world as, these are the pictures that sum up this movie. I've never done that job in my life. I always was what they call a specials photographer. And normally what that meant was you'd go on set for a day or two and take some pictures and they'd use it for publicity. But being a Bond film, it's bigger than that. And so that was do a book. I think the first film I must have worked 50 days on that set.
Wow.
Came and went. Never too many in a row. I always found that if I spent too long on a set, I would... I mustn't be bored. You know, I realise that now, particularly when I work at a really fast pace now. So if I have all day with someone, I'll reduce most of the shoots to a couple of minutes of intense photography.
Mm-mm.
And then we review, we look, we talk about what we want, and then we go again. But I sort of, you want a high energy, not only in your subjects, but in you yourself as well.
Yeah,
you can't
course,
keep
yeah.
high energy. You can't keep high energy up for 12 hours. You know.
Well, there was. You know, it's kind of infamously. There's a lot of sitting around on movie sets,
yeah.
And that's you don't want to be doing that, right? Because your energy level is going to dip, and that's what you're basically
Absolutely.
Talking about.
Yeah,
but the fact that you were given the access, I mean, clearly they wanted that. But I would also expect them to be really cagey and sort of guarded about letting people onto the set, especially with Bond, which is sort of so kind of protected. You know, as a kind of, but. Again, it seemed like you were welcomed and they let you do your thing.
Well, one thing to be clear of, every picture I ever take of anyone, I show that person the picture.
Mm.
You know, I've always... It's a funny thing when you work with magazines, they say, oh, don't give them approval. And I'm like, well, but everyone sees my pictures. You know, what possible advantage is there to me in a photo that Pierce Brosnan doesn't like of himself being out there with my name on it? How's that? How's
you
that
shooting yourself in the foot? Yeah,
yeah. It just never made sense to me why everyone's like, oh, you know, you did this big compromise. It's like, yeah, but I stopped being a photojournalist in 1997, right? I'm not a photojournalist. I'm not a member of the press.
Mm.
You know, I take photographs that are photojournalistic in style, but I'm not trying to uncover some dark truth about my subjects. I'm trying to take really cool photos that ultimately promote the entertainment industry. Do you know what I mean? It's like, got to be really clear on that because, you know, that's what we're doing here. And I think people can, it's easy to lose a bit of sleep on that stuff, and you shouldn't. You know, and also you rarely lose great photos.
But also that's why you're in the position you're in, because there's a trust there and people, you know, it's a small world and, you know, people talk to each other in that world, it's the same as in any other. And so, you know, if you piss Daniel Craig off or whoever, everyone else is, you know, that would be very counterproductive. Whereas for you, it's almost like the more people give you their trust, the more that feeds on itself.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, I wanted to ask you about the Bond thing, because obviously you know, you're kind of, that's become your kind of job, partly, or you're the official unofficial Bond photographer. I don't know, now that Daniel's gone, of course, I don't know what's on the cards for you, but you know, everyone's fascinated.
I don't have a clue.
You don't? No,
I don't have a clue. It's also weird to hear, because yes, obviously I've done a lot with Bond. It's just I've done a hell of a lot which hasn't been with Bond. Do you know what I mean? I've no idea what's going to happen next. I've no idea who, you know, who might be in that role and whether I'm going to be invited to be a part of it.
Because I think it was Daniel Craig who sort of brought you in a way. You already had a working relationship with him, and so it was that came from that you kind of, I mean, you'd already done the Bond
years. I'd had a strong relationship with Eon Productions and with Barbara and Michael, because I spent, you know, like 50 odd days on the set of Pierce Brosnan's last movie. But I'd met Daniel about a year before he got the role, maybe 2 years before, and I photographed him on Layer Cake, and then I did a few portrait shoots with him and got to know him. And in fact, I even shot the screen tests. I shot the screen test for Casino. So I shot Daniel and the other people that were testing. for it. But yeah, it was very much like, you know, when, you know, it was sort of said that, you know, if this goes this way, then it would be great to have Greg around, which was obviously fantastic for me.
No, and I'm not trying to suggest that's all you do. There's so many things clearly that you do that are not to do with that, but they're such huge productions, and they're such, when they are in production, you know, like they're shooting for a year or whatever it is. It's a bit, you know, it's kind of unlike anything else in a way.
No, it really is, and it's been, and sorry, I don't want to do that down either. It's been a huge part of my life, and it's a huge feather in my cap, and something that I'm immensely proud of. So I'm not doing it down either. It's just certainly in the last few years, there's been big years of gaps of time between me working.
Yeah,
on
of course. I'm curious about one thing, which is like when it's Bond, when there's so much riding on it, when it's such a huge deal, is there a kind of palpable sense on set of that pressure, or is it just everyone going about doing their jobs because they're all kind of super good at what they do? Do you know what I mean? Do you feel that sense of this is a Bond film and there's like not only is there $200 million riding on it, but it kind of has to work, or is that not really?
I think in any situation when you're at the top of the game, right, like Bond is, or like being side of stage at the Oscars, or like, you know, when you're doing the big game, right, whenever that is, there is a strong sense that this is the time to this is not the time to fuck up, right? Yeah. This is the time to get it right. And I think everyone brings that because everyone's immensely proud of being there and being a part of it. Do you know what I mean? So you want to do it, and I'm not sure how much that turns into palpable nerves. There's probably a point of nerves, but you know, when you're on day 14 of working on something, you're not walking around nervous. You're just in it at that point.
Now the other thing that you seem to be quite kind of committed to is this teaching, this kind of workshopping, or rather these courses that you've got going on. You seem to be genuinely kind of keen to share your knowledge, I guess. You know, even on Instagram, where you sort of do these lovely kind of little behind the, you know, the kind of explanations of things.
I call them photo breakdowns.
I find that really interesting. What is it about that that you sort of, because obviously there's, you know, I mean, it's, but some people kind of keep their process close to their chest, and I mean, I've spoken to 170 photographers on this podcast, so I know there's plenty of people who are happy to talk about it, but you're sort of sharing it, you know, in a more formalized way now because you've got these courses going on.
I'll tell you what it is that because I'm for the most part just me and a camera, right? I am closer, much closer than someone whose work relies on a format, you know, on a large format, for instance, or someone whose work relies on a particular grade and crunch, or someone whose work relies on a certain light. I'm much closer to someone using their mobile phone than most other photographers at the level at which I'm working. And for me, I think, you know, it's a weird one because obviously it is years and years of experience, but I find photography so easy. And the way I've got it down now, it is so simple. And, you know, like so I do a pro course, which is quite expensive, and I do a thing called Skills Faster, which is substantially cheaper. And in 65 minutes, I will make someone who says, I can't take a good picture, if they concentrate for 65 minutes, I will show them how to take good photos and they will take better photographs. My wife's a classic example. She's always said she can't take a good picture. And literally, I've had this course on for like a year and a half, and about 2 months ago, she did it. And she's now, you know, she's taking better photos. And it's simply getting people to think about where light's coming from and how it falls and how that light changes depending, like I said earlier, where you put yourself and your subject in relation to the light, and to think about story. to think about what's the narrative of this picture. And I suppose probably the other simplest thing is exposure, simple exposure, not exposure like having to understand the difference between f-stops and shutter speeds, but like bright and dark. Yeah. You know, the idea of exposing for your subject, not for your picture, and just getting people into that mindset, really simple things. And I don't know, I take pleasure in it because I think it's a cool thing to do. We've never ever communicated visually to such a level as we do today. You know, you go on holiday now, and rather than saying, sending a postcard even, or sending a little description, you just send one photo that sums up the most beautiful thing about your holiday. That says it, right? 6 billion people are taking photos on smartphones today, and most of them have no idea that they can control their exposure because they don't even know they should think about it. Most of them don't think of standing up from the table and walking over to where the picture is. Most people don't think that if they move, 6 foot round to the left, that the light would be much more flattering on someone. And so I'm just teaching them these simple things. It's not all altruistic. I'm making money selling the courses, but the photo breakdowns I've been doing for years before I was doing the courses, and certainly my website, if anyone's interested, go to gregwilliams.com and there's a learn section, or in fact any of the pictures that have a little italicized eye in the bottom right hand corner, you click on that eye and it tells you the story. There's a video of me explaining the story of how I took the picture. And as I say, not completely altruistic, because I'll also maybe offer you can buy the camera that I took it on, or you can buy a print of the picture that I'm talking about. So there's obviously business intertwined into it. But there is, for me, this idea of democratizing good photography that I absolutely love, just like Jamie Oliver democratized good eating in the UK. You know, Britain eats better for Jamie Oliver.
Mm.
You know, they literally do. Your average British household eats better. And I like the idea that, that I can be someone that helps every man take a better photograph.
Yeah, and like you say, I mean, of course, it's, you're a kind of good example of someone who's sort of embracing the so-called creator economy, which, you know, I've heard about. I personally have not managed to kind of crack that myself, and we all know podcasting is a tricky thing to monetize, but yeah, of course, you're just making the most of the fact that you've got this knowledge, and I don't know, do you have any idea about how many people have signed up and bought one or other of the courses?
So Skills Faster, which is the amateur course, we're up to about 40,000 sales now.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah,
so it's proper, it's really proper.
Yeah.
And the reviews are fantastic. You know, the people, apart from the odd troll that goes, oh, you can't take a photo, what the fuck are you talking about, mate? Apart from those guys, it's really, it's really positive.
Yeah.
And it continues to, month on month, they just sell, They continue to sell.
I should sort of mention that, I mean, the price point for that one is at a kind of level that you don't have to think too much about. It's currently available, I think, for £34 on your
yeah,
website.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So it's like...
I say that because it fluctuates.
Yeah, right.
But people cleverer than me do that for me, and it works somehow. But yes, that's the kind of price point.
Yeah, and the pro course is a lot more involved and therefore more expensive. But, I mean, was it a big undertaking to sit down and kind of structure these courses?
So the pro course is a lot more expensive because we expect to sell far fewer of them, and it was a lot of effort.
That's what I was going to ask you. How hard was it to sort of, you think, oh, well, it's, I'll just, share my knowledge, but you've got to sit down with a blank piece of paper and actually structure it and figure out, how to do that.
I mean, it's a lot of work. And when I say a lot of work, it's not years' work, but it's, if you added it all up, it's weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks of work getting it. And I'm I'm good when I'm talking to you, but when I've just got to sit down in a camera and stare at a lens and just speak to it off the top of my head, I'm not the most natural in the world at doing that. So it is, I'm getting better at it, but I think there are other people in the world who would have probably done it quicker than me.
Well, you got there, that's the main
We
main
did
thing.
Get there, yeah.
Yeah.
But also, like, for the pro course, we literally, you know, we did one shoot that was very expensive, you know, because we obviously do lots of big shoots. We did a studio shoot where we really break down all the different lighting scenarios that I use and how they compare to real life daylight scenarios. Because I don't think of, I think of studio lighting as recreating an ambient light. It's not there to be studio. It's there to look like, you know, you're in a studio because that's where you're doing the job, not because because you can control the light, but not because you want it. I don't ever want my pictures to look like they were highly lit. You don't want people thinking about the light. I don't, you know, a lot of photographers do, but for me, I want people looking at the subjects and looking at the narrative more than going, wow, that's really clever lighting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is that why you favour black and white as well? Because the colour is, in a way, a kind of distraction?
Honestly, I favour black and white for three reasons. One is that, to me, I'm obsessed with the heyday of photojournalism, and in the heyday, there wasn't a lot of colour going on, right? Mm. That's one reason. Another reason is a really mad practical reason that... when I'm like busy, so say I'm at the Venice Film Festival, I don't have time to colour grade the pictures.
Right.
And so, you know, the simple fact is I take a picture of someone getting off a boat and in the background there's someone with a bright orange hoodie on. In a colour photo, that fucks you completely because the eye goes to the hoodie. Do you know what I mean? The eye's not going to your subject, they're going to the bright orange hoodie. And I just don't have time when I'm on the move to make those changes. So that's one practical reason for it. And then the other thing is that the photos, it's also for the talent. There's something about, you know, there can't be an actor in the world that doesn't want a bit of Marlon Brando. Do you know what I mean?
Or, yeah, well, that's what I was going to say.
Or an actress doesn't want a little bit of Marilyn or a little bit of Sophia Loren or a bit, you know, and so there's something that your photos, it's weird. I've got pictures that I've done. Funnily enough, there's a photo of Daniel Craig in Bond leaning off the DB5 car, black and white, Casino Royale. And it already has the feeling of a classic. And that's probably because we've gone on this entire journey with Daniel. And so we see him and he's undeniably younger than he is today. And the car goes all the way back to the 60s. And so for whatever reason, that picture in many ways feels to me like my first classic photo that we've, you know, and it's only 20 years old, but it's 18 years old, whatever it is, but it feels like a classic. And so there's something about creating pictures that feel like they're going to age well. You know, and it's something I do in my styling as well. I, you know, whenever I have control over styling, it's never fashion, it's never trendy. It's never trendy. You know, when it's my choice, it's rarely going to be one of those tuxedos that wraps around someone. It's going to be a classic tux that you could have expected Paul Newman to wear. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's what I look for. And when it's casual, it's not got big blazing branding all over it. And it's just classic and timeless. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I was thinking that. You know, you talk about the sort of golden age of photojournalism is your reference, but, you know, but there's also the sort of golden age of Hollywood, which, you know, I guess you're referring to with Brando and people like that. So there's, you know, you're kind of following on with that tradition in a way, and those, the people who are now, those Hollywood A-list, I mean, they've got to love being part of that lineage in a way, I suppose. So it just makes a lot of sense. Now, are you going to get into the podcasting racket? You know, I know you've had a foray into that, but you can't have time for absolutely everything, mate.
So look, I did one, which I don't know if you've heard it, but I did one with Gary Oldman about his wet plate photography. I went to his house in California, and he's got a studio and a dark room. and we did a shoot together. He shot me, which was really mad experience.
Yeah, I haven't listened to the audio, but I saw the pictures.
Yeah. So and I loved it. And so I was gonna. The plan is that with Hollywood Authentic magazine, we're gonna do. Basically, I won't do podcasts like this because I don't have time. But when I'm doing my interviews, I video the interviews. And so the Gary Oldman podcast came around by videoing the interview. And then I gave my friend, who's a podcast producer, all the audio from the video. And she pulled together a script where we took the audio from the video as the colour. And then I narrated it. And so that's the podcast. So I do intend to do more. Yeah, I really enjoyed it, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's like the only thing you're not involved in. It seems like, you got a little bit of thing. You've got so much going on, basically, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I don't know where you find the time for it all. Are you a planner? Like, do you kind of sit back and think, you know, this is where I've got to go and make lists about stuff? Or does it just sort of seem to happen organically?
No, I mean, don't get me wrong, the jobs are all, the commissions are organic, but the commissions are increasingly, so I have to phrase this right, it's not they're becoming smaller, but I'm almost trying to divide my life in half now. I'm very mindful that, you know, I'm 50 now. When I'm 60, I'm certainly not going to be running around doing as many commissions as I am today. So at some point, and it's sort of where part of the education comes from, it's part of where Hollywood Authentic comes from, and certainly part of other things I've got planned. I'm making more and more products. I'm making accessories. I've got an idea for a few things product-wise. And certainly the aim is that stuff represents more and more of my income in a year. So last year we got it to, and print sales as well, right? So last year we got it to nearly 50-50, where my non-commission money is about the same as my commission money. And my aim is that with time I'm going to move it more and more over to that, so that, and I suppose the commit, and so more and more of the commission work sort of becomes almost self-commissioned. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the idea of Hollywood Authentic, is that, you know, if we've got money coming in from lots of other places, you become and don't get me wrong, I am much more picky now. Like, I'm now in a position, you know, and the Instagram's got a lot to do with that, but I'm now in a position where I definitely turn down work if it feels wrong, even if the money's really good. And I'm able to do that because I've got income coming from other channels.
Yeah,
other sources. So if that increased, I would put a huge amount of effort into Hollywood Authentic. There's this lovely saying, my mate Al McEwish, he's a fantastic creative director in advertising. He says, only do what only you can do.
I like that, yeah.
And it's wonderful. And that, you know, the horrible truth is that when I was starting out as a photographer, I couldn't afford to listen to that. I didn't have family money. I wasn't independently wealthy. I really refused to do other jobs. Like, I was very motivated to make this thing work. But I absolutely did huge compromises that I wouldn't consider doing today. And I did work that I would never, you know, I mean, I'd show as an example of me selling out, but I'd never show it as an example of work I was proud of, right?
Well, because when you start out, you have to do whatever comes along. You've got to pay the bills.
Exactly. You have to do whatever you have to do. And so now I have that as a bit of a mantra for my dear friend Al. So it's only do what only I can do. So if a job comes in, I go, could only I do this job? And if I couldn't, then I think very hard about whether to take it or not. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing with that is you've got to have quite a lot of self-confidence to think that, you know, this is the only, you're the only person who can do that, in a sense.
Mate, I started at 6. I got that self-confidence at 48. Right, 48. Right. It took a long time.
Yeah,
it's a long time coming, and it's not an overnight thing. And it's very weird. It's very weird finding success. Like, literally, I'm 50 in August, and I've probably would consider myself successful for the last 3 years.
Mm.
As in, I've sort of feel like I've worked that stuff out. It takes a long time.
Yeah,
this stuff.
And you've like you say, you've created that situation, and it was back to that thing of deciding where you wanted to be and then figuring out how to get there, I suppose. Mm. And
but it
and,
is that know, it's attrition, you know. It's you think most people, when they sort of shine, they normally shine in their 20s and 30s. And so to sort of be getting, not that I'm shining necessarily, but I'm certainly at a high point in my career now at 49.
Yeah. There's hope for us all then.
There's hope for us all, mate.
I'm a bit older than you, and maybe I could still get to a point of feeling that way.
Mate, there is hope for us all.
Greg, thank you very much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I very much appreciate you coming on and sharing your story and giving me the time.
All right, Ben. Well, look, thank you so much. Had a lot of fun.